everybody. Welcome, welcome. What you just heard there was the WHA fight song for the Whalers back when they were part of the World Hockey Association. And that's from the early 1970s right there, 1972 vintage. So really happy to share that with you. And as always, the theme song is definitely an introduction to what we're going to be talking about today. So we'll get into that here in just a little bit later. But I just want to say, yeah, you betcha. It's great to be here. And we're a little under a week from Christmas. My day job's definitely slowing down for the new year. So, I mean, what else do you need? You say you need a little bit of hockey? Sure, we got you covered. You know, you don't need to wait till January 13th when the NHL comes back. And once again, kind of like last week, I'm still a little skeptical, but it looks like things are moving quite along well towards that goal. So that's good. But like I said, hey, we're going to look into another great hockey book here. So I got you covered for this week's episode of From the Point. And remember, I'm Danny Lambert, your host, if you're just tuning in for the first time. So in the history of professional hockey, there's been a lot of teams and actually a lot of leagues. When you think about it, we really sometimes only think of the NHL when we think of professional hockey, and especially the highest level of professional hockey. If you look at the early parts of the 1900s, you can see a professional landscape that is far different from the one that you know, or even the one that we all knew to exist in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. The NHL really didn't come into existence, or now, you know, what we know of, until 1917. And after that, it still struggled to become the only top professional hockey league in North America. It still wasn't till about the mid-20s when the NHL finally bested the Pacific Coast Hockey Association and the Western Canada Hockey League, who merged in 1924 to compete with the NHL, just to disband 2 years later in 1926. And that's when the NHL really started to see itself alone atop of the ranks of professional hockey. So they were the sole league left, and they took control of the Stanley Cup, the major markets for hockey, and really the best players. They even contracted the league down to six teams in 1946, leaving the owners of the remaining six NHL franchises in excellent shape. They didn't have anything to really worry about. They didn't have much competition. So during the original six era, it can be said that the owners were in complete and total control of the economics of the game. There was no players association, no accession to the now, you know, sole top league that wasn't through a system of team-sponsored junior clubs. And once players signed into an organization, that organization owned their rights for life until they were traded or released through the use of what they used to call a reserve clause. And we've talked about that before, which was definitely standard in NHL contracts in those days. Even the game's greats like Gordie Howe were subject to unfair and often bad faith contract negotiations with the team owners, who would only pay what they wanted to and not necessarily pay what the player's market value was. The owner's hold on the players continued for years. The players finally put together a solid union in 1967, and it looked to be that they were on the road to more fair dealings with the owners and the franchises. But it can be said that they were only going to be able to go so far because of the first NHLPA president, Alan Eagleson's shady and often far too clumsy relationship, or chummy relationship, with the NHL and its owners. But in 1971, the NHL ran into something it thought it'd never run into again after the 1920s. Serious competition from another major hockey league in North America. Promoters Dennis Murphy and Gary Davidson, who had founded the American Basketball Association and directly and successfully took on the NBA, got the idea that they could do the same with hockey. Motivated by advocates in the markets that were forgotten and sidelined by the NHL, Murphy and Davidson in 71 started to lay the foundation of a new league to take on the NHL monopoly that would be called the World Hockey Association, or WHA. The resulting league was nothing short of exciting extravaganza that not only took on the NHL establishment, forcing them to change for the better, but they changed the way the game is played for forever, pretty much. Dubbed the Rebel League, the WHA would play for a tumultuous seven seasons from 1972 to 1979, until the NHL merged with the league and absorbed the Edmonton Oilers, New England Whalers, who became the Hartford Whalers, Quebec Nordiques, and the Winnipeg Jets. The stories of those seven seasons are neatly tied into what sports authors consider to be one of the best books ever written about professional hockey. That book, The Rebel League, The Short and Unruly Life of the World Hockey Association by Ed Willis, is the subject of this week's episode. And frankly, I'm excited to talk about this one. So let's get into it. The warm-up is up next.
I was sitting here reflecting on his last year's accomplishments by the WHA. Many critics felt that we would not make the full season with 12 strong franchises. Of course, we have, and now we're entering our second year, looking forward to even a better and bigger success in the first year. We had season attendance last year that exceeded our expectations by almost double. This is one of the rewarding things that we received as in the management position of the league, having the fans accept the WHA as Major League Hockey in its first season. They wondered what kind of players we could possibly come up with, and our all-star team showed them. We had such players as Jerry Cheevers, Ron Ward, Danny Lawson, Wayne Carlton, Tom Webster, Ted Green, Johnny McKenzie, and the Golden Jet, Bobby Hall.
So what you heard there was from the man himself, that was Dennis Murphy, the founder of the WHA, sort of just giving you a little bit of a summary of what the first season of the WHA held and the optimism that he had at the time, which was probably even a little bit shading some of the realities that were even present back then that we'll get to as the league really did start kind of on a shaky foundation, but still with a lot of hope to have success. So welcome to the warm-up. I just want to start out by saying, you know, hey, most people really forget that many of the greatest hockey players in history really didn't start their professional hockey careers in the NHL. Hockey Hall of Famers like Gretzky, Messier, Gartner, and Markell all started their professional careers in the WHA. That's how good of a league it was. Also, add to that the fact that there's another list of Hall of Famers that were defectors from the NHL that joined the WHA ranks like Gordie Howe, Bobby Hull, Jerry Cheevers, Dave Keon, Frank Mihalovich, and Bernie Parent. And you can see where the WHA was not only looking to exist with the NHL, but compete directly with it at the same high level. Still, through the lifespan of the WHA, the league was a roller coaster, both on the hockey side and on the management side. The cast of characters who took the ice, the quirky non-traditional markets with their fan bases, and the owners who ran the circus were all part of the fabric that made the Rebel League story not only a pure hockey gem, but one of the best sports stories ever. Ever since Bobby Hull's parade down Portage of Maine in Winnipeg announcing the defection of one of hockey's greatest talents to the Rebel League, the WHA's legacy also became much more than just the fun stories behind the loose spending and crazy on-ice spectacles. It was also that announcement that in the WHA players could find a fairer compensation that they now had in a way around the reserve clause and the leverage to force labor relations to change in the NHL and professional hockey overall. Sure, it can be said that Bobby Hull's motives for signing with the Jets wasn't exactly about his fellow players, but in the end, it had a ripple effect that was the mechanism to the eventual demise of the reserve clause and the beginning of true NHL free agency, and really free agency for all the major sports leagues. Also, the WHA made it possible to expand into non-traditional hockey markets. The exposure and, most of all, lessons learned in markets like San Diego, Birmingham, and Houston offered the NHL a blueprint and a set of lessons learned to place teams in markets today like Tampa, Dallas, and Raleigh. It's doubtful that had the WHA not come along, that the NHL would have been so bold or have known what to do to survive in these non-traditional markets. So that's just a high-level look at what the effect of the WHA was, which is certainly an important part to the lore of professional hockey history. But for me, it's just the fun stories. That's about the WHA that makes it perhaps one of the funnest, interesting points of history in the hockey history. One of those stories, most of those stories are found in the book Rebel League. Ed Willis does an excellent and amazing job to tell a concise story of the league and making sure that you get the facts behind the founding, running, and downfall of the league while just having a good time reading about it. Still, at the same time, he tells interesting stories about the events and characters that made the WHA more flamboyant and more fun than the rival establishment league, the NHL, in the 1970s. It's stories about how Derek Sanderson used his monster contract to buy a Rolls-Royce, but was initially kicked out of the kicked out of the dealership for looking a little too casual. It's how Ben Hatskin, the owner of the Jets, really didn't have the money to offer, much less sign Bobby Hull, but was able to get it together through some interesting means. It was how the Birmingham Bulls were essentially the most aggressive, most violent team ever. And just to highlight that, you know, the story about how they had 10 players in the penalty box within the first minute of play was certainly an interesting thing to read on the pages of a book. Willis tells you all the good stories, while at the same time educating the reader on the issues that made the league great and the ones that really sort of doomed it from the beginning. I felt it to be the most perfect mix of detail while covering a wide array of topics I've read in a sports book almost ever. To write a concise history of seven seasons, as well as the league's founding and disbanding in a matter of 304 pages, was nothing less than a stroke of genius. You're going to laugh out loud one minute, you're going to shake your head the next, and then you're going to shudder in disbelief after that. Willis captures the essence of the WHA in just about every page and every word that he writes. So as we look to kick off the first period, like most things, it's best to start at the beginning. And in this case, it's all about the founding of the league and the reasons and realities that led to the establishment of the WHA and the issues that really plagued the league from the beginning. Hold on, we'll be back with the first period after this.
There was no shortage of parties looking for an interest in a professional sports team. Murphy had a line he loved to use. Would you rather sell brassieres in Muskegon or own a hockey team in Detroit? And a lot of men with money wanted to own a hockey team. Franchises would come and go, seemingly in the middle of the night. The Dayton Arrows became the Houston Arrows. The Miami Screaming Eagles became the Philadelphia Blazers. The San Francisco franchise moved to Quebec, where they became the Nordiques. There were teams in Edmonton, Ottawa, Winnipeg, and even Toronto.
I guess this is the thing that that really got the WHA going is when Cleveland and Cincinnati were not awarded franchises in the National League in 1972. And when they decided to join the WHA, it sort of gave them the credibility that they needed, because now they had some top American cities and people, and not just a sort of a Canadian, Western Canadian league. So out of that, of course, followed in hockey, the reserve clause was eliminated in hockey. It was the first sport, I believe, it was eliminated. Technically, all the players became free agents.
Got to apologize up front for the audio on that one, but at the same time, that was from a documentary about the WHA, and that particular part is about the founding, and really, I liked it to kick off this first period because it just gives you a sense overall about that, especially when they talked about Murphy talking about going out and seeking owners and just sort of selling the league to them. I mean, that's a very important part about what the league was about, and then just sort of the volatility that was really there from the beginning, and that's where we're going to start here in the first period. So I think the best way to start this discussion about the WHA and the business behind it is to start with a quote that adorns the first page of chapter one. Quote, "They knew nothing about hockey, absolutely zero." That was a quote from Bill Hunter, who was the then president of the Western Canada Hockey League, talking about the WHA organizers and founders, Dennis Murphy and Gary Davidson, who looked lost when Hunter took him to an LA Kings game to basically introduce him to the game of hockey. Dennis Murphy swears that the WHA was something that he just thought up while he was on a plane flying to Los Angeles in 1970. His previous experience in establishing the American Basketball Association, or ABA, was his guide. Murphy was a visionary, and when he met Davidson, who was a lawyer with connections, the combination was just right as they grew the ABA into a true competitor. It was simple that the two men would pitch in $5,000 each to make a franchise, scout for owners, and get a second big star on board. It worked in the ABA's case, so why not for hockey? In the establishment of the WHA. The only problem was they had one small issue. As mentioned earlier, the two knew nothing about hockey. Luckily for them, they found plenty of people like Bill Hunter to help. In their search for owners, they found even more allies who understood hockey and were willing to help. The idea, also much in the mold of the ABA, was to establish the WHA's franchises in cities that were snubbed by the NHL, while still competing directly in some of the NHL's largest markets. One of those allies was that of Winnipeg businessman Ben Hatskin, who formed a triumvirate with Hunter and Scotty Munro as the Canadians who would steer Murphy and Davidson in the right direction on the hockey front. After incorporating in June 1971, the WHA started out the process of building and essentially cold calling for owners with the promise that a WHA franchise would only cost $25,000 for a franchise fee, and Murphy, ever the salesman, was making it seem easy as he severely undersold the estimated yearly operating costs at $1.25 to $1.5 million, which, if you know anything about hockey economics, even in the 1970s, it's quite the underestimation. Still, drilling it down further, Murphy was explaining that all the teams needed to do was use a bulk of their payroll to sign a few superstars and use the remaining payroll to fill out the team with enough players to fill the roster wherever they could find them. The idea behind this payroll was simple. The league would take on the NHL by offering more money to their superstars to defect to the new league, and then their presence would eventually grow the league, even if there was a sharp drop-off in talent with the players that were below them. The product would still be good enough to draw people with the NHL superstars. So it was a year later, after much hard work by Murphy and Davidson, that in June 1972, the WHA was on the eve of its inaugural season with 12 franchises ready to play. The New York Raiders, the Cleveland Crusaders, the Philadelphia Blazers, Quebec Nordiques, Ottawa Nationals, New England Whalers, Winnipeg Jets, Alberta Oilers, Houston Aeros, Los Angeles Sharks, Minnesota Fighting Saints, and Chicago Cougars. It looked like they'd be able to mount a strong challenge to the NHL, and it also looked like they would be able to take on a season schedule that almost exactly mirrored the NHL's. There really wasn't much difference. The WHA and the NHL were going to start and end at about the same time. Still, economic assumptions that Murphy used to sell the league were flawed from the beginning. It ended up that many of the franchises had to enter into very lopsided deals with arenas to get them rented, as in the case of New York, they had to, in Toronto, those were two big ones that had problems like that from the beginning. Both clubs were renting from NHL landlords who both squeezed the franchises from the beginning and really made it to where they were subservient and going to pay for their having to use the NHL rinks. Also, in many markets, fans did not come out as expected because the WHA had overreached in their assessment for the market to accept hockey, or in some cases, if the market was enthusiastic enough for hockey, just as they didn't see the WHA as a peer competitor to the NHL. Add to that, the initial salary estimates to lure superstars from the NHL ended up being much more than originally thought. Murphy had sold owners on the fact that they could probably sign superstars for about $150,000 a season, whereas it was taking much more to get them to make the jump. Take, for instance, the Philadelphia Blazers signed Derek Sanderson to a contract that paid him $530,000 a year and also took on Bernie Parent, who was paid $140,000 a year. So that was really about half of their advertised operating budget tied up in two players. We'll go into the Sanderson contract details in a little bit because it's definitely very important, but we're going to wait till period two to really drill that down. But for now, you just have to understand that that's just an example of how the Blazers were spending a lot of money on players and didn't have a whole lot left for the rest of the team to operate or to even fill out the roster. Furthermore, it cannot be understated that the idea of directly challenging the NHL by playing during their schedule was really a bad idea. Initially, it was thought that the WHA season should be a little bit off from the NHL's. But in the end, they decided to take on the NHL, an NHL-like schedule, and lost many battles for media coverage in the process. Had they had been a bit off the cycle and the only hockey game on during certain parts of the year, they may have garnered a little bit more attention that they needed to get off the ground and continue to grow in an upward trajectory. But instead, they decided to take on the NHL, and in many cases in the PR realm, we were losing the battle from the beginning just because of the relative unknownness and newness of the league. And if all that wasn't enough, and even before the league even started, there were issues with the actual finances of the owners. It was easy to get the 25 grand franchise fee up front, but settling up the operations was a little bit tougher, making sure that you had enough money. So many owners found it hard to generate the capital they needed to actually start. Some were forced to move even before the first season started, like Dayton moving to Houston. And in some cases, the franchise was starting in a tremendous hole that would not be sustainable and would cause much of the volatility years later when so many of the teams each year would move or simply fold. But for all the shaky ground that the league was starting on, it had one really big thing going for it: the ability to change the player compensation game and actually steal a sizable crop of legitimate superstars from the NHL. Calling it straight player emancipation, the WHA knew that they could mount a huge legal challenge to the reserve clause and get it nullified. They almost knew they were going to win from the beginning. That was enough to entice the signing with the WHA for many of the NHL players. But the NHL teams were still mounting legal challenges that were shot down by federal courts, except for the Blackhawks challenge, who tried to block Bobby Hull's move to the Jets. This made the lawyer and Davidson work overtime and welcome the legal challenge by the Blackhawks to put the reserve clause on ice for good. And as fate would have it, they would be able to deliver on their promise as the WHA got their case heard in Philadelphia U.S. District Court by Judge Leon Higginbotham, who was known to be friendly to labor rights and was, as expected, struck down the reserve clause in November of 1972, paving the way for NHL players to sign with the WHA if they were not under contract already. The effect was that 67 NHL players were lured away to the Rebel League to start the first season. It looked like the league, as shaky as it was, could be viable and might actually be able to deliver on its promise to compete with the NHL directly. It was a product that could be certainly different while offering some of the same excellent hockey at points and not so excellent hockey at others. We'll take a look at that on-ice product, the players, and the stories behind the seven crazy seasons of the WHA up next in the second period.
Believe it or not, the World Hockey Association has arrived. And facing off for the city of St. Paul, Mayor Larry Cohen.
Here we are, is it or isn't it? Hockey Town, USA, St. Paul, Minnesota. Lots of luck to the Fighting Saints on Friday the 13th. I've had a hell of a lousy day on budgets.
As we look back on the first season, I think it's remarkable that things went just very much as we thought they might. All in all, I felt that our players did an outstanding job. They were in nearly every game all year long. We won, I think, 16 one-goal games, perhaps more than anybody else in the league, and just hung in there very well, despite the fact that we did come up quite short in the goal-scoring department. I thought that because we were having trouble scoring, our defensive play by the whole team, an outstanding defense corps, some very solid goalkeeping, and a lot of diligent work by the forwards kept us in game after game and in a position where we could get ourselves into the playoffs despite the fact that we were having considerable trouble scoring. We did have some tremendous individual performances over the year. Of course, Curran established himself early as one of the best goalkeepers in the league, and Jack McCartan did an excellent job along with him. Coming up with key save after key save, these two men gave our team a lot of confidence that we could compete with the very best in this very tough league.
That was a pretty cool clip right there. That was the year-end review of the Fighting Saints from 72 and 73. And what you heard there was the introduction of the first game in the St. Paul Civic Center and just the excitement that was around that. And then Glenn Sonnemore talking about the team and their ups and downs during the year. Pretty cool. But it's a good way to talk about the operating years of the WHA from the start with some excitement, and the excitement that was definitely around the league in 72-73. But really, when you look at it, the best place when you want to discuss the operating years of the WHA are in the recruitment and signing of the best forward in the game in the early 1970s. That was Bobby Hull. Bobby signing with the Jets is not some, you know, kind of lost story in the annals of hockey history. It's something everybody knows. I mean, heck, we've already talked about it in this episode once, and then I reviewed went over it extensively during my review of the Devil and Bobby Hull. But why is it important to the start of the Rebel League? It really is important because it showed the other players around the NHL and the professional world three things. First, the league was serious in its challenge to the reserve clause. They were willing to try to pluck Bobby Hull from the Blackhawks, even though they knew they would have to challenge his reserve clause. Second, if Hull was signing, then maybe their WHA was serious about having a strong on-ice product if they're going to bring in such a superstar like that. And then third, and probably most important, you can make a ton of money in the WHA. Hull's contract for $1.75 million over 10 years plus $1 million signing bonus had the effect of raising salaries in both leagues almost overnight. The NHL had to up their game to prevent further defections, and the WHA needed to bring in more talent and just decided to make the players offers they couldn't refuse, even if that was a salary that was beyond the budget of some of those cash-strapped startup franchises in the WHA. The Hull signing had the effect of more NHL superstars making the jump to join Bobby in the WHA. Big names like Bernie Parent, Jerry Cheevers, Derek Sanderson, and J.C. Tremblay all made the jump to the WHA, and it looked like there would be more to come. And there was, when Mr. Hockey, Gordie Howe himself, came out of retirement to play in the WHA's second season to join his sons Mark and Marty in Houston. Also, the WHA offered a quicker way to the professional ranks by not abiding by the NHL's 20-year-old minimum draft age, instead opting for a minimum age of 18. For junior players, they could jump into the professional ranks much faster and easier by signing with the WHA. Many NHL teams were clogged with talent, even in their farm systems, but the W offered them a quick way into a high level of pro hockey. It worked to get some of the best young talent of the day, like the two Howe boys, and then later on in the league's history in the late 70s with players like Gretzky and Messier. Still, even with a respectable influx of NHL-level talent, the WHA was filled out with the ranks of players that might not have seen the professional light of day had there have not been a WHA in existence. Still, the WHA had competitive teams, and when comparing them to the NHL clubs at the conclusion of the WHA, the Rebel League has actually won more games in interleague exhibition with the NHL franchises than the NHL has. That's an interesting fact, so maybe they were doing something right there. But sometimes you had some NHLers get paid way too much to jump leagues and simply just bust out, become a bust in the WHA, never living up to the big contracts that they were signing. The best example of this, and perhaps the most infamous example of being overpaid in sports history and not living up to expectations at the same time, was Derek Sanderson and the contract that he signed with the Philadelphia Blazers. As alluded to earlier, the Blazers really should have signed Sanderson. They really shouldn't have signed him for financial reasons, but it can also be said that the hockey reasons were also in play, as he was a big part of the Bruins' two Stanley Cups in the early 1970s, but he was never really a huge scorer, never surpassing the 30-goal mark. Still, the Blazers gave Sanderson a $2.6 million five-year deal, and he became the highest-paid athlete in the world. He'd only play 8 unremarkable games as a Blazer due to injury and was bought out by the end of the 1972-73 season, returning to the NHL at that point. And if all that wasn't enough, we're starting to get into the blood and guts of the hockey in the 1970s. As the talent lacked, the violence escalated. We've talked about that in previous episodes, certainly. The WHA was notorious for bruisers and franchises like Birmingham and St. Paul. At the same time, it seemed to make a product that resembled Slapshot rather than a professional hockey league at the highest level. Teams were being built solely because they wanted to have a violent team to sell the game. Not that the NHL was much better about that at this time, but it was obvious that the lack of backhand talent forced the WHA into a more violence-based hockey at times. But for all that, you still had some awesome hockey that changed the sport that was going on in the WHA. Eventually, the Winnipeg Jets in 1974 would lure over two Swedes named Anders Hedberg and Ulf Nilsson to play with Bobby Hull, and they formed the Hotline, which dominated the W for four seasons. They posted a combined 573 goals and 1,377 points in 855 games together. It can also be said that Sweden and Scandinavia were largely untapped to that point by North American hockey, and the success of Hedberg and Nielsen paved the way for heavy Scandinavian presence in the NHL today. It is said that the skill and creativity of the Hotline is a model for many of the offensive schemes today, and that the Hotline is one of the best lines ever assembled in professional hockey history. It also cannot be understated that WHA brought in not only the sons of Gordie Howe, but Mr. Hockey himself. And unlike many who attempt to come back and fall flat, Gordie was still Gordie when he came back. I mean, he won league MVP in his first season. He still hit and scored like he did in his 20s, even as he was pushing 50 years old. Also, watching him skate with his kids on the same team was a total PR gold rush for the Rebel League. Something that definitely the bold way of bringing in the Howes paid off in spades. But for all the great play mixed with crazy violence, many of the WHA venues were certainly not worthy of the highest level of hockey. In Houston, the Sam Houston Arena, built in 1937, had a huge bug issue, and players were known to have to shake out their equipment before games and before they left the arena to make sure that they didn't have visitors with them in the different towns they go to on their road trips. In Cleveland, the Crusaders eventually moved out of their first home, the Cleveland Arena, after two seasons, but had to make their franchise's start in a barn that still sported chicken wire instead of plexiglass. Even when the Crusaders moved to their new home, which was dubbed State of the Art, it was in Richland, far into the Cleveland suburbs, and made it hard for people to get to, making yet another obstacle for the sport to grow, especially in the city of Cleveland. The Chicago Cougars played in a 9,000-seat capacity arena that was near the cattle pens on the south side of Chicago, and of course the arena smelled like a cattle pen. In the case of the New Jersey Knights, who started out life as the New York franchise, the situation in New Jersey was so bad that they were said that there was a hill at the center ice, and that players would get after skating through center ice, would get a downhill slide. Also, if that wasn't enough, players had to put their gear on a nearby Holiday Inn and then be bussed into the arena in their gear if you were a visiting team. These poor buildings had two major effects, both with the same result. The league looked substandard compared to the NHL product that they were competing with, who had beautiful arenas in almost every market that they were playing in. Also, there was the fact of TV coverage, that it was not as lucrative back then, really, for either league. The WHA would need to put fans in the stands to generate revenue, and with the barns being low capacity and seedy, it just made it harder to sell tickets and make revenue. Also, add to that, in many cities where WHA franchises directly competed with the NHL franchises, the WHA team shared the same arena and often were forced to play at the odd times that were unfriendly to fans, with the NHL team getting the deference for the weekend and night games that really helped get fans in the stands. That hard ability to generate revenue made for a very unstable environment for fans. The WHA lineups of teams fluctuated so much from season to season that in its 7 years of operation that they never passed a year where multiple teams didn't relocate or just outright fold. Of course, this made fans often reluctant or unable to latch on to a WHA team for fear that they might not be there the next season. I'd list out all the changes that occurred to the franchise of the WHA, but it was numerous, and we only have so much time. I don't think you want to hear me talk that much. If you really do want to take a look, there's a wonderful YouTube video that describes it all from the beginning of the league to the end of the league, what the contractions and the movements were. So check that out on YouTube. It was obvious from the beginning that while there was some good hockey being played in the WHA, the other stuff like arenas and overall team stability was making it hard for fans to be invested. And it would be that lack of revenue and shaky financials that consumed the league and overshadowed whatever good hockey was actually being played in the WHA. It's really a miracle that the league lasted for 7 seasons. So let's take a look at the end of the demise of the WHA and what the legacy of the league is in the third period up next.
There will never be a merger. Merger is a term, it is a substantive term, that the National Hockey League will never engage in a merger. A merger is where you take two bodies, put them together, and you create a new one. There will not be a new organization. There will always be an NHL as far as I'm concerned, and I think as far as the owners in the NHL are concerned. Will we expand? Will we expand to WHA cities? I don't think anybody can predict that. Right now there is an exploration.
So that was the then NHL president John Ziegler talking about what the WHA-NHL merger would look like to a reporter. What I found was really important on that, which you want to clue into, is that he's really quick to correct the reporter and say this is not a merger and it's expansion by the NHL, which is really funny to me because it seems like the NHL is reluctant to have any sign that they're defeated or bested by the WHA, that they wanted to let everybody know that the WHA, they were doing the WHA a favor and that this was just an expansion of the league. So, but we'll clue into a little bit more about why you want to call it a merger rather than an expansion, in my opinion, later on. But what we want to start off with is just to talk about what the downfall looked like and how we got to that point with the merger. And then at the end of the period, we'll just talk a little bit about what the legacy of the league actually is. So by 1976, the situation in the WHA was starting to look pretty grim. It had been 4 seasons and the stability was just not coming. The volatility of the beginning was not subsiding, and in some cases it seemed to be getting worse. Heading into the 1976-77 season, the WHA saw the Ottawa franchise fold outright, and then the Cleveland Crusaders moved to St. Paul to take over as the new Fighting Saints, as the original Fighting Saints franchise had folded. Things had continued their downward spiral heading into the 77-78 season, as the second iterations of the Saints, the Crusaders, actually folded. San Diego folded, Calgary folded, and Phoenix folded as well. The league knew they needed to do something, and they needed to do it quick. The route that seemed the best to try was to try and merge with the NHL. Some argue that that had been the strategy of the league since its inception. Owners like Hatskin and Winnipeg had always wanted the NHL to take a look at expanding into their market, but the NHL never took the effort seriously, and thus it was thought that their main motivation for teaming up with Murphy and Davidson was to force a franchise into the NHL through completion and a proof of concept for their market by having a WHA franchise there. So it can be argued, and some people really think, that a merger with the NHL was really the whole point of the league to begin with, at least in some of the minds of some of the owners. So that was why in 1977 the WHA decided to enter into merger negotiations with the NHL. Merger discussions had been going on for almost pretty much from the beginning, like we talked about in 72, but now both sides were finally set to have serious negotiations. John Ziegler had replaced Clarence Campbell as the NHL president in 77 and thus saw the rift with the WHA more from a money loss standpoint, as opposed to Campbell, who along with old school owners like Bill Wirtz of Chicago, Harold Ballard in Toronto, and Paul Mooney in Boston, had always seen the issue from the standpoint of they wanted to stick it to the WHA and didn't want to give in to the Rebel League and give them any seat at the table, no matter how much money they were losing both sides. The merger discussions looked to be going well that summer, as the framework seemed to be laid out for six WHA teams, Cincinnati, Houston, Winnipeg, New England, Quebec, and Edmonton, all set to enter the NHL. The six teams would enter the league and completely intact the way they are and play in their own division of the NHL. The Rebels thought they had a deal, but in the end, alas, it was put to a vote, and it was said that the influence of Ballard and Mooney rallied forces to defeat the merger by only one vote. So fresh off of being shot down by the NHL for pretty much what would be petty reasons, WHA clubs took on an aggressive recruitment of young talent in the summers of 77 and 78. WHA clubs snatched up young superstars like Wayne Gretzky, Mark Messier, Michel Goulet, and Mike Gartner, all who went on to be inducted in the Hockey Hall of Fame. Make no mistakes about it, these were prized prospects, and the NHL clubs and the league wanted their hands on them, but they didn't get them. The WHA had beat them to the punch with a new emphasis on trying to best the NHL. So heading into the 78-79 season, the WHA still had some issues as Houston folded and Indianapolis looked to be on shaky ground from the start of the season. But the on-ice product was looking exciting. The influx of new talent that was generational in manner made it seem like the WHA could make it through. Birmingham, for example, had finally shed much of its brute squad image as they built a young team featuring nine future NHLers, including Michel Goulet, Rob Ramage, Ken Linzmann, Craig Hartsburg, and Rick Vave. The WHA looked to be growing its stock on the ice, and it looked pretty much like they could probably get by with that into the future. But alas, even though the on-ice product was a lot better, it was finances that were plaguing the W that year. By the end of the 78-79 season, after handing out what would be the final Avco Cup to the Jets, only six teams remained in operation. It was a situation that looked to get worse, and so the WHA was forced to the negotiation table, but this time the NHL had a far greater advantage, as it seemed that the WHA looked as shaky as ever. Not to mention, the NHL looked to be a bit more energized to make a deal, as they were eager to get their hands on the young talents that the WHA had recently stole from them. Still, when a proposal to vote to get the remaining six teams in again happened on March 8th of 1979, the NHL voted it down once again by one vote. It had been the old heads once again, as before, that led the charge to block the Rebels. But as Willie's explains, fate would step in at this point, and Canadians and their love for beer would change the minds of one influential owner. The Molsons still owned the Habs at that point and saw a boycott in cities like Winnipeg, Quebec City, and Edmonton after it had been released that they were the one of the franchises that had voted to block the merger. The pressure got to the Molsons, who in turn pressured Vancouver to change their vote as well. And if that wasn't enough, the Canadian House of Commons approved a resolution supporting the merger. The merger was put to vote again, and this time passed 13-4 by one vote on March 22nd of 1979. The new deal was for only four teams to enter the NHL, which was Quebec, Winnipeg, Edmonton, and Hartford. Cincinnati was paid by the other teams to fold, and Birmingham joined the CHL and existed for two more seasons before folding. The four teams that made the merger were forced to pay $6 million each in franchise fees over the next 5 years. By the way, it should be stressed that the NHL was reluctant to call it a merger, as we discussed earlier, wanting it to call the addition of the four WHA teams expansion instead. Once again, it seemed to be more of a saving face method rather than trying to actually call it what it was. It was a merger. On the player's side of things, it was a little more complicated. The NHL had really been interested in getting their hands on the WHA players, not necessarily the WHA markets. So the deal struck was really slanted towards the NHL, as they made a very convoluted system that was complicated to explain, but I'll attempt, so here goes. Each WHA team could protect two skaters and two goalies. All players on NHL protected list reverted back to their original teams. That was the players who were drafted by NHL clubs or just playing jump ship to the WHA while playing for an NHL club. The funny part here is all but 45 WHA players were on NHL clubs protected list, making the deck fairly stacked in favor of the NHL franchises when it came to getting players. After the NHL teams got their players back, they could also protect two goalies and 15 skaters on their roster when the WHA team, it would become the WHA team's turn to pick from those unprotected players, or they could also, the WHA franchises could pay $125,000 a piece if to get players that weren't on the protected list. And finally, if an NHL team lost any player, they could just go ahead and protect another one. It wasn't like they just got their protected list, and so they could keep rolling their protected list to make it more expansive. So what ended up happening was is the NHL teams would only be able to lose a max of four players. Oh, and if that really wasn't enough for you to realize it was probably slanted towards the NHL from the beginning, WHA teams would be picking at the end of the draft that season was another part of the deal. This reclamation draft, as it became to be known, had the effect you'd think. It hamstrung the WHA teams for years. The Jets were never really successful. The Nordiques had to move before they really won the Cup. Hartford had to move as well. And Edmonton, for as good as they became, it still took two seasons for them to win anything, even with Gretzky and Messier. But it was the NHL's way to get what they wanted and not seem like the Rebels had had in any way won. So, I guess like any other conquerors, they just decided to make the deal a little bit more slanted to what they felt was the winners. Still, in the end, I'd have to say they did win a victory. The game is really better because of the WHA. Players are more fairly compensated now. It's opened up non-traditional hockey markets to consideration, and the WHA had to find players from outside of Canada to fill its ranks, and it can be said that the rise of non-Canadian players in the NHL started because of the WHA. Most of all for me, it's the fact that the Rebel League showed the NHL that tradition was fine to admire, but the future was something that might not line up with tradition. Had it not been for the WHA challenging traditional stubborn ways of the NHL, would the game be what it is today? Would we even have a game? Being bold and challenging convention was what the WHA was about. If you don't believe me, take a look at a picture of Gordie Howe in an Arrows jersey with his kids and wonder, is that really Gordie Howe in that jersey?
12 seconds remaining as they drop the puck. Now it's been to Chipperfield. He lost it. And the Jets get it. It's played to the Oilers line. And the crowd is just deafening here. By a score of 7-3. It was their fifth final series in the seven-year history of the league and the third time that they won the cup. Now, the ushers are trying to control the crowd, but they're just pouring over the boards out onto the ice, and it's a real mob scene down around the Winnipeg goal. At the opposite end, it's a little sadder. The Oilers have gone back to regroup, compliment each other, and now they're coming up single file for the traditional post-series handshake if they can get the Jets loose from all of their fans and each other. We're number one. You can't argue with that. Yes, they are. And now the players are shaking hands. The Oilers will go to their dressing room, and the Jets will stay out for the presentation of the AFCO Cup. And they will have permanent possession of that cup, having been the last team to win it, as the WHA is now officially no more. Next year, it's all one league, the NHL, with four fine teams coming into one of the oldest professional leagues in North America.
That was the call from the last AFCO Cup game, which was the last game played in the WHA, with the Jets winning the cup in the end. But what I thought was really funny, what stands out, is the play-by-play guy talking about how this is the last Avco Cup being handed out and the impending merger with the NHL. Kind of an interesting way to look at it, but yet again, a good punctuation and great way to start this post-game wrap-up as we get into it. So, I mean, as you figured out, the WHA was certainly a wild ride, and hopefully you've come to learn that it was a wild ride that was completely necessary. All the players who played in the W seem to remember the good and really not the crazy. But even when they do remember the crazy, they can just sit back and laugh about it, is what I've noticed. Even though in some cases, because of the craziness, they were living from paycheck to paycheck. Lucky if they got paid on time or if at all in some cases. Still, it was the idealism of the venture known as the WHA that I think really punctuates the seven tumultuous years of the league. And, you know, the historical footnotes that permeate throughout the story of the league that we know of now. The undoing of the NHL's reserve clause was probably one of the most important things because of the way it opened up free agency, not just for hockey, but for all sports. What's more, it always seems that it can be argued that Murphy and Davidson's main motivation was that they were looking to challenge the reserve clause to get players away from the NHL, but it cannot be understated that while their motivation might have been just to get players away from the NHL, they improved the lives of professional hockey athletes and professional athletes everywhere in the future. What's more, they knew they could win even before they started the challenge. I found that to be really kind of crazy, but still kind of cool. But from the hockey perspective, it cannot be understated that the changes the WHA made to the sport made the sport more remarkable and put it on a path that the game is on today. Would the stalwart hockey cities like Calgary, Winnipeg, or Hartford, Carolina, now which is now Carolina, be in the NHL today if it were not for the WHA challenging the NHL to break out of the safe markets and take a chance to grow the game? Would massive talents from the U.S. and Europe have had doors open as wide to the NHL if it were not for the WHA making the NHL search for talent to fill out rosters, having to make them go to places outside of Canada in the major junior hockey system? Would that have happened? We certainly wouldn't have had the overtime system we have and today without the WHA. That is something we can definitely say for sure. I know it seems funny that at this point it seems like I've largely left out references to the book Rebel League, which is the topic of this episode, but I'm going to say the words of the book are all over our discussion today. That's how awesome this book is. Willis uses outstanding research along with just excellent interviews with all the players to spin the story and to keep you hooked and entertained. In my opinion, it's what the book it's what a history book should be. Educational from first-hand accounts, rounded out by research, and tied together through chronology and context. Basically, if you read Rebel League, you'll walk away with knowing the story of the WHA seven seasons after only an in short investment of 261 pages. See, normally I just give a generic go read this book endorsement, but for Rebel League, I will need to say you need to read this book. It's a journey that every student of the game needs to take. The story of the WHA is so important to the history of the NHL and hockey that if you don't understand it or study it, you might wonder how Gordie Howe became a Whaler, which I'm pretty sure most people have. But if you read Rebel League, you'll be able to answer that question and so many more. Oh, and you might learn that Ogie Oglethorpe from the movie Slapshot was actually based off a real player who played for the Fighting Saints. But if you want to hear about that, read the book, because I've already used up too much of your time. And like I said, you need to read this book. Okay, folks, that's it for me. I'm going to call this episode Dunsky. As always, it's been a true pleasure discussing one of my absolute favorite hockey books with you, and I hope you've enjoyed it and you've learned a little something along the way. And as always, if you like what you've heard, please give the show a subscribe on your favorite podcast type place, and be on the lookout for new content every Saturday, as that's when I release my episodes. Also, please take a minute to follow us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, for daily facts and even maybe some giveaways. I'm trying to give away cards, but all I get is those stupid bots retweeting me. So if a real person actually retweets and likes the page on Twitter, I might actually be able to send you some cool hockey cards. So please take a minute. It's worth your while. But looking ahead to next week's episode, we'll be driving back into the world of brain injury and CTE, as I'm really happy to feature a book that I recently finished that was recently published here called Finding Murph, How Joe Murphy Went From Winning a Championship to Living Homeless in the Bush by Rick Westland, a senior correspondent for TSN. It's really a great book, and I'm going to be happy to discuss it with you next week. So till then, thanks again for tuning in, and as always, stay classy, hockey fans.